Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is an Overcoat Media production.
Welcome to Memento Morbid, where we explore death, life, and the in-between. It's hosted by me, Joanna Ebenstein, founder of Morbid Anatomy, an organization and community devoted to these very themes. Hello. During this episode of Memento Morbid, if any names, books, ideas, or artworks spark your curiosity, check out the podcast show notes for more. You'll also find a link to our Substack, which contains imagery discussed and additional content. In today's episode, we'll be exploring the concept of time, of the finitude of our life on Earth, and how we can use our knowledge of that as a way to help us live better and more fulfilling lives.
I began writing the Guardian column with a certain kind of idea that I was doing it rather sarcastically, skeptically, that I was kind of pointing and laughing at a lot of the terrible stuff that is in the self-help space. But I did sort of go on a journey to greater sincerity as a result of it, because I realized that an awful lot of what I was looking for and a lot of what people are given in sort of conventional productivity, time management, personal development literature is this kind of seductive promise of being able to leave behind your limits, of being able to sort of transcend the basic limitations of time and control that we find ourselves with as humans. And that's basically why it doesn't work and is a recipe for more and more torment and stress, because you're trying to get yourself out of the human condition.
Before we bring in our guest, let's hear a listener's thought on their own relationship to the ideas of time and its finitude.
Hello, my name is Charlotte, and I'm calling in from Brooklyn, New York. What I'd like to share about death for the podcast is not one specific story, but just how the death of my brother at 22 and I was 19, and how that shaped the rest of my life. I often think of his absence as a shape that I have kind of molded my life around. So it's not that he's absent, but his death is a presence that I kind of use in my life as a philosophy, as a sounding board. He's always there in death, as in life.
Thank you so much. If you have your own offering, a reflection, memory, or encounter that you'd like to share, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Oliver Berkman, a British author and journalist best known for his work on time management, mortality, and the pursuit of meaning. He is the author of The Guardian's This Column Will Change Your Life, and his 2021 book, 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals, explores how embracing the finite nature of existence can lead to deeper fulfillment. Berkman's recent work, such as Meditations for Mortals, continues his exploration of how the awareness of mortality shapes more intentional living, arguing that accepting our finitude enables us to let go of unrealistic expectations and focus on the things that are truly important. So Oliver Berkman is not only an amazing thinker and writer, but also a friend of many years with whom I have developed my own ideas over long meandering dinners. And he is also part of the Greater Morbid Anatomy community, for which he has taught and lectured a variety of times. So welcome, Oliver.
It's a huge pleasure to be here and have this conversation, even if we can't have a long, rambling dinner.
Well, I do hope you'll take me up on the invitation and come do that. I would love that.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've talked a lot about our ideas and our work over many years, but I've never formally asked you about your trajectory. And I found myself wondering when I was putting these questions together, If you could kind of describe the path that took you from your Guardian column and then through that to the power of negative thinking and through that to your work on like focusing on mortality, how you ended at this point, or if that was always a part of your thinking.
I think probably I wrote that Guardian column, I began writing the Guardian column with a certain kind of idea that it was that I was doing it rather sarcastically, skeptically, that I was kind of pointing and laughing at a lot of the terrible stuff that is in the self-help space. But I did sort of go on a journey to greater sincerity as a result of it. The really surprising thing was finding out that there was kind of value in those ideas. And I think in hindsight, really, I was probably looking for them and needing them, right? I was very anxious as a teenager and young adult. I was sort of perfectionistic and uptight and wanted to find a way to handle all the demands that were being made of me and feel calm instead of stressed and feel like I was doing well enough and all those things. And so I think that was what probably sort of led me one level of subconsciousness down, whatever I might have told myself, into that material. But then what happened, and this was kind of the real revelation to me, is like, turns out that if you sort of spend years and years and years writing columns where one of the things you're doing is looking for the kind of magic bullet that's going to solve all your problems, and you fail to find it, and you fail to find it, you keep failing to find it, eventually you actually start to wonder if maybe this is not the right question to be asking of life. And that's where the sort of finitude focus and the limitation stuff all came in for me, because I realized sort of gradually and then suddenly that an awful lot of what I was looking for and a lot of what people are given in sort of conventional productivity, time management, personal development literature is this kind of seductive promise of being able to leave behind your limits, of being able to sort of transcend the basic limitations of time and control that we find ourselves with as humans. And that's basically why it doesn't work and is a recipe for more and more torment and stress, because you're trying to sort of get yourself out of the human condition in a basic way. And then the big revelation for me from all that has just been the idea that actually if we can sort of turn towards these limits a bit more and accept them a bit more and sort of live into them a bit more, it's not only a path to less anxiety, it's actually the more meaningfully productive and constructive and generative way to live. So it's always been that focus on limit, where I feel like your focus has been on death itself. And I find that an interesting contrast in certain ways. You know, it's the limitation that ends with our death that I'm so interested in, maybe more than the death part. I don't know. Let's talk.
Yeah, no, I think it's super interesting. And I think listening to you talk, I was thinking how coming to the idea of death is like the last logical step of so many questions, you know? And I feel like sometimes if you stay on any one path long enough, that's where you end up, because that is the essential human problem, mystery, conundrum, you know, the thing that defines our humanity. And I think it's so interesting looking at your body of work and thinking of our many conversations that this is where you ended up too, you know? And I think probably I started somewhere else too that wasn't about death that ended up here as well. So I think that's super interesting. So in your book, 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals, you quantify the average human lifespan. I wonder why you chose to think about it that way and if that's helped you personally and what you think that provides, thinking about it in this kind of very clear limit.
I mean, yeah, so 4,000 weeks is the very approximate average lifespan today in the developed world. I mean, it's incredibly approximate because I wanted a nice round number. I think, you know, you don't need too much luck to get a few more than 4,000. I mean, what I love about that is it's kind of shocking and both funny and terrifying at the same time, which is certainly something that I'm drawn to and a tone that I go for, I think, in my work. But also it's like the weeks thing just really drives home the fact of limitation, right? Because if you express the human lifespan in average human lifespan in days, well, a day is incredibly short. It's incredibly easy to waste a day, but the number that you get of them is pretty high. Yeah. You could express it in years, You don't get very many at all, but they're big things, and it feels quite difficult, although doubtless possible, to waste a whole year. The weeks are like the worst of both worlds because you don't get very many of them. And yet, like, I don't know, what happened to last week? I have that thought all the time, right? It's, they race by. So that was really just a sort of slightly sensationalist way of driving home this fact of the limitation. But it is the finitude that interests me, right? It is the fact that it has an end that is so defining of everything that we do and that we are. And so sometimes people have asked me, like, well, what if all this Silicon Valley biohacking works and people live to three times the current lifespan or something? And, you know, if they ever completely solve death, as they say, and we're immortal, that's a whole other ball of wax. But in fact, I don't think 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 weeks would affect the fundamental point here, which is just that, like, it comes to an end. The fact that it comes to an end has all sorts of ramifications on a very granular day-to-day level in our lives. And it's really hard to even begin to get your mind around the fact that it comes to an end.
Yeah. And have you found that thinking about it in this concrete way has helped release you from your own anxiety about productivity and doing the things that you felt at the beginning of this path, you know, kind of driven to do? Has this changed your life in a radical way?
You know, I honestly think it has, on that level of kind of day-to-day, the degree to which one beats oneself up for not doing all the things when you really understand in your bones how no more than a tiny fraction of the things are ever going to be done in any limited period of time. I think I'm still relatively anxious as people go, but I'm way different to how I was, a couple of decades ago, part of which is probably just getting older as well, but it's these two things are interlinked. I think I have found a real kind of solace and calm and sanity in sort of letting go into that state of finitude instead of sort of what I was doing before. And I think what a lot of people do, which is without realizing it, spending all your time and strategizing endlessly to sort of not have to feel that that is the truth.
Yeah.
And I think that's been very powerful. What I thought you were going to ask, and we don't have to talk about this, but
no, bring it on.
I am by no means convinced that this has done very much to sort of reconcile me to my mortality itself.
Mm.
And I don't think I'm necessarily in any way ahead of the curve of the population in that respect. I don't know if you'd say you are.
Well, let me ask you a few more questions because I think, this is an interesting conversation and we can go deeper. I think we can drill down a little bit into this. What is it that you find, if it's not too personal to ask, is it a fear about the end? And if so, can you pinpoint what that fear is? Or is it more like just the idea that you don't have time to do all the things you want?
So firstly, I have a lot of fear of the emotions that are associated with losing other people. I am either blessed or cursed at this point in my life to not have sort of very immediate experience of close bereavement. Who knows? But I don't think that anything that I've done with all this finitude stuff necessarily is a way to not be knocked completely sideways by those sort of waves of emotion. You know, I've been one or two steps removed from very, very, very tragic kinds of bereavement. So I've had the opportunity to sort of understand it one step away and to participate in a sense. But that is a big mystery to me. In terms of my own death, well, I think, you know, everybody has, I assume, fears and worries about pain and suffering and illness. But to me, it's more just like there's something so outrageous on some level about the idea that, like, all the things are just going to carry on and I will not experience them. I think this is a familiar way of talking about the sort of incomprehensibility of death, right? There's something about my experiencing of the world unfolding and the world unfolding seem very close. It's made me sound like a sort of psychopathic narcissist or something.
No, not at all.
All of history is about me or something. But the notion that will just keep rolling on and on and on, and I am denied absolutely all of it completely, does seem, it seems like a it seems like some kind of insult or something.
Yeah. And it makes me think of how, when I look at medieval imagery related to the Grim Reaper, that's exactly the feeling I get from that depiction. There's a sense that, I don't know if you can, you know, put in your mind like one of those woodcuts or engravings of the Grim Reaper with a totally horrific visage, and he's pulling you out of life, you know, against your will, kicking and screaming. I think this is a familiar feeling, what you're talking about, that feeling of not wanting to give up these earthly pleasures, this earthly life, you know? So I can totally relate to that. I would say, and maybe this is getting older too, I don't know. Part of me is just relieved that I'm going to die at some point, because life is really hard, you know? And maybe that says more about me than it does about death itself. But I feel, I am not afraid of death, but I am afraid, as you said, of suffering. And I'm afraid of dying in a plane crash. I'm afraid of drowning. I'm afraid of ends that are violent and unpleasant. And but I'm not afraid of the actual. I think from all the work I've done, I've become much more curious about death and see it as kind of this mystery. And I'm kind of eager to see what happens, you know?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, that's fascinating, because obviously this does come down to differences of intuition about whether anything happens.
Yes.
There's a paradox built into the idea of kind of being offended, as I was expressing before, by not being there, because the person who has been insulted in that way is not a person anymore. If we're leaving aside sort of the continuation of life or consciousness after death, which I by no means leave aside with any certainty or anything, but it's where my sort of mind has traditionally ended up. So it kind of doesn't make sense for me to care what happens after the only thing in me that can care is no longer present. But yeah, it would be very interesting indeed if that were not the case. And then it would also not be the case that I was denied more experience, right? So I don't know. Yeah.
You know, how you're talking really reminds me of the Stoics. And I think they do such a good job of framing exactly this paradox, right? Like, if there's a me that's worried about death and death as an end, then it's a totally false worry, because there's no me to be outraged, you know, once death happens. It's a preemptive outrage.
Yeah, exactly. And who is it? Is it Epictetus? I can't remember who it is. I'm blanking, but there's a very famous Greek philosophical account of the irrationality of fearing death, which is that we don't fear all the time before we were born. So why do we fear all the time after we die? I think that's kind of rubbish. I mean, the reason I don't mind about before I was born is because I had never been there in the first place. And my preemptive outrage at not being here anymore is because I now am. But yeah, there are strange things going on. I think, you know, one of the downsides of the Stoics, I suppose, is that there is a certain tendency in the original work, and certainly in the way it gets sort of popularized these days, to imply that, like, once you've been shown that it's irrational to have a certain viewpoint or feeling,
that suddenly you're just going to feel
it
better.
It just goes away. Yeah, right. It's not my experience.
No, it's not my experience either. But what you're talking about really reminds me of one of the things I really love about your work, and even before you started dealing explicitly with mortality, which is how you have this really broad and deep knowledge of so many traditions, from philosophy to psychology. And I was wondering if, in all of your kind of learning about these traditions and incorporating them into your work, if any of those, probably not Stoic from the sound of it, but any others have been really useful for reducing fear of death or making you feel differently.
Yeah, I mean, so thank you for the kind words. And I mean, my approach to this has always been, I always think of what I'm doing as very journalistic, right? So I feel like that's my sort of spiritual practice the level of openness that I aspire to is one where anything that is relevant can come in, rather than saying, you know, I work in the psychoanalytic tradition, or I work in the this or that tradition. But that said, yeah, certain things keep coming back. I think the most obvious one to talk about besides Stoicism is kind of Zen Buddhism specifically. I think the Zen version of Buddhism, because it speaks to my kind of left brain analytical type personality, you know, it meets me where I am as a kind of intellect first person, but then leads you to more interesting places than that. And I suppose the relevance of I mean, well, firstly, the fascinating thing, as you know, about death in Buddhism in general, just in the broad brush, doubtless very caricatured perspective, is that it's kind of the goal in some sense, right?
Yeah.
It's like the real point about reincarnation beliefs in parts of Buddhism is not that you get reincarnated into better and better lives, but that eventually you don't have to be reincarnated into a life at all. You get to step off the wheel. So it's kind of strange and interesting to begin with, and actually echoes something you were saying just before, right, about the idea of there being a sort of relief or solace in the fact of death. I'm trying to figure out what it is about these expressions of these things in Zen that really speaks to me, and I don't necessarily know a huge amount about Zen views of death specifically, but there is, I suppose, in Zen, the idea that like what lies behind the screen of concepts that we lay over the world, the sort of total uncertainty and uncharacterizability of what reality really is behind our ways of trying to put edges on it and words to it and ideas to it, that actually there's something very sort of welcoming or hospitable about that kind of great uncertainty or great doubt, and that really the problem that we have in life, the thing that causes us suffering, is trying to solve that problem. It's not the fact that everything is ultimately totally insecure and uncertain and transitory and impermanent. It's the fact that we really don't want it to be and struggle all the time to try to make it not be that causes the problem. And so the idea that you can sort of rest in that kind of total uncertainty is, firstly, just in general, very helpful for anxiously inclined people. But secondly, it suggests in the context of mortality, it's just like, well, okay, maybe the fact that I can't really begin to understand the fact that I'll die, maybe that's a portal to something rather than a sort of terrible impediment on my part. The fact that I can't sort of get my conceptual claws around it, maybe a problem with the conceptual clause rather than a problem with reality.
Yeah, which makes me think of the Zen koan, you know, this kind of statement that kind of takes your logical mind offline because your logical mind actually just can't sink its conceptual claws into it.
Right, exactly. It's in the trying and the failing that you understand something new.
And that maybe, your mind goes to another level that it makes me think of the work of Carl Jung, who I know that you're also acquainted with from your experience and research, and that idea of the transcendent third, right? That idea that if you can hold this tension of opposites, then something completely unimagined might come in, a new way of understanding that will solve that problem by transcending it in a sense, you know, like your mind goes beyond that dual thinking, I guess, which is what gets us there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I love that way of putting it. I think it is very closely related to that notion of like the suffering is thinking that there ought to be a solution on the level at which you... So the quote that I used at the beginning of 4,000 Weeks from Charlotte Jocko Beck, who was a American Zen teacher, who said, "What makes it unbearable is your mistaken belief that it can be cured." And I always love this. I assume by it, she means life, right?
Or death. I mean, it goes back to what you were saying at the beginning of Silicon Valley is kind of attempting to solve the problem of death, right? This belief we have that it's a problem to be solved rather than something, the existence of which defines our human existence and our philosophy and everything else. You know, I think that's super interesting.
I think that's really interesting as well, because like it's a difficult discourse to get involved in because you don't want to say that like making lots and lots of improvements to people's healthy lifespan is a bad thing. But I'm always struck by the degree to which certain people in that space don't seem to see what seems obvious to me, at least on reflection, which is that the fact that life comes to an end, the absence of that would be a kind of total meaninglessness. Because, I put it this way in 4,000 Weeks, there are a million different ways to put it, but like, if we lived literally forever, then the answer to the question, like, should I do X or Y with my time today, would always be like, who cares? Because there's another day to do the other thing, and there's another 1,000 years to be married to 1,000 other, to 100 other people, you know? So it would just, it just, when there's no sacrifice or trade-off involved in the decisions you make, they don't have any meaning. And the reason that it matters to be with one person in a relationship or to live in one place or to use an hour of your time in a certain way is because you can't also do all the other things in a finite life.
Yeah, I love the way you put that. And I love how you talked about it as sacrifice. I hadn't really thought about it in that way before. But I think that's really, really beautiful, actually. And, you know, the etymology of sacrifice is to render something sacred, right? Isn't, as I recall. So I think there's just something really interesting about that. And I think that's a really interesting point as well. It would definitely take a huge existential shift of probably hundreds of years to reacclimate as a race to being rendered immortal. You know, like I don't know how you would find, maybe eventually there'd be a new way of thinking that would find value, you know, but it would probably take a long time. It's just such a basic part of what we are as human beings.
I remember there's a line from a think piece in an American Catholic magazine with the headline, "Heaven, colon, will it be boring?" you have the sense in that sort of, that it's like somebody's just like, hang on, I've just had a horrible thought, you know, because maybe there are good arguments against the idea that heaven would be boring. But if what we're talking about is life stretching on and on and on forever, I think it's a very natural conclusion to reach that that would be profoundly empty in some way.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your most recent book, Meditations on Mortality, and how you came to do that as a follow-up to 4,000 Weeks. And what can you talk just a little bit about that book and what it's like?
Yes. So I'm afraid the title Meditations for Mortals is, I mean, it's the picking up on the for mortals part of the of time management for mortals. And it is very much about finitude and limitation. I don't know whether I get any deeper into the morbid anatomy core curriculum there than in the other books. But subject matter wise, it's really, you know, I'm always just writing a book that I need to read at any given point. And if 4,000 Weeks is sort of about coming to terms with limitation of quantity of time and control over time, I guess Meditations for Mortals is above all about sort of going from having a good idea about how you'd like to be showing up in your life and living your life and your finite weeks on the planet to actually doing it. And how easy it is, at least for me, to have all sorts of brilliant notions about what my life should be like and how I ought to spend my time, and then just do something else, you know, scroll through social media for days on end. So I really wanted to get into that question of like, why do we not do these things? And how can we move across that gap? So it's 28 short chapters divided up into 4 weeks. And the idea, it's not a rule, but it's a suggestion, is that you might read one of them every day for a month. They're very short, each one. The idea was really that I wanted to get around this problem with a lot of self-help personal development books, I think, which is that they either just sort of communicate a big perspective shift and then you're like, okay, but what do I do with this? Or they give you like 1,000 steps to follow and you're like, okay, I need like a spare month to put this system into practice. And I wanted to sort of, in the same spirit of limitation, right, not say to people that you need to clear the decks first in order to benefit from this, but this could be something that just sort of wove its way into your existing day with your 10,000 unanswered emails and, you know, too many things to do and people making demands of you. And so it's a very sort of step-by-step journey through different ramifications of really feeling what it is to be finite through the course of kind of the everyday activities. And what I hope comes out of it, I'll stop now, sorry, I'm going on. But what I hope comes out of this is just that, like, again, this isn't, for me, this is not a counsel of resignation or settling for less or for a mediocre life. It's like, it's exactly through coming to terms a bit more with our limitations that we can accomplish the most impressive things, live the most sort of richly present and meaningful lives. So it's very much sort of, I hope it's kind of ambitious in that sense, right? It's ambitious for what life can be once we begin to face what it really is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, definitely I'm 100%, as you know, 100% in agreement that that is, at least for me, the most useful way to clarify actually what I want to do with my time on Earth is to realize its limitations and to have the courage to actually do those things, despite the very real fears of putting yourself out there, trying something new, moving to another country, whatever it is, right? So I'm a million percent on board with that. And I agree with you. And on that note, I know you share exercises in that book. Are these exercises that you use yourself, or is there any particular exercise that's been really useful for you in there?
Yeah, I always feel it's important to kind of ground anything like that in the principles. So I'm sort of what I see myself as doing in the book, I guess, is sort of communicating some principles and then saying, like, by the way, here are like a whole bunch of ways that you could put this into practice. And then, you know, some of those are going to work for some people and some aren't. It's going to be very dependent on your situation. I don't think the principles are dependent on your situation, because I think they're timeless truths of human existence. But, you know, whether you can structure your day so as to do sort of 3 or 4 deep focus hours on your core work before moving on to the rest of the day, for example, which is one of the chapters that will, you know, there are plenty of people who just aren't in a position to do that. So I'm much more into the sort of spirit of the methods than necessarily the details, but there are lots of them. Yeah, I mean, one very simple one that sort of speaks to what we've been talking about is just the idea of keeping a done list, right? Keeping a list of things that you complete through the day, as opposed to always only focusing on a kind of list of all the things that are still remain to be done. Mm. Just because it has that very simple effect of reorienting your perspective from, you know, comparing your output to an infinite number of undone tasks, and to instead comparing your output to what if you'd done nothing at all, right? And to actually understanding that, you know, doing 6 or 7 things in the course of a day is a good achievement for a finite human being, and not doing an infinite number is no failure in any meaningful sense. So that's just one of them. And then there are a whole lot of others like that.
Yeah, I think it almost sounds like applied gratitude. You know, I feel like even doing lists of gratitude, I found very useful for the same reason. It's like suddenly it just shifts your perspective. You can think of 5 things you appreciate every day, even on a shitty day, right? Suddenly you just see in a different way. It allows you a different perspective on exactly the same content.
Right. That's a really good point. And I've often been a bit turned off the sort of language of gratitude.
It's super cheesy,
but it's not the way you put it. It makes me see, right? It's not so much about ginning up these huge feelings of how blessed you are. It's about turning away from endless speculation about how things ought to be, turning instead to how things actually are, and seeing that in amongst how things actually are, there are things that are just easy to see are wonderful.
Yeah. And I think it also helps you appreciate just the more prosaic, simple pleasures that our culture doesn't take seriously necessarily. Like some days it's just like, I practiced my Spanish. It was nice weather. You know, like it doesn't have to be like this life-changing moment, but it I think it helps you, as you said, to notice what's happening in the here and now and to shift yourself accordingly rather than, this concept of what should be. Yeah.
Right. And I think it's, you know, it's not even that those little things are little in a sense, right? In a sense, anything you're doing to show up more fully for a moment is like, that's the whole game.
Yeah.
And sure, you know, in any life, a few of those moments will be kind of amazing successes or wonderful gifts, but it's really just the being present for as many of them as much as possible.
Yeah. And on that note, do you feel like all of your work around these ideas has changed in a significant way your relationship to your life and others, the other people in your life?
I mean, I do, but I think you should ask my wife and a friend of yours as well, whether when it comes to questions like, am I a calmer and less anxious and less, you know, jerkish person to deal with? I think it really has, because I've found with both of these most recent books, certainly, this very strange phenomenon where I sort of have to undergo a personality change in order to finish them. Mm. I come up with a kind of a decent idea at the book proposal stage, and it's all quite intellectually coherent. Mm. And then actually turning it into a book almost requires me to kind of become more like the person I'm evoking in the book. Otherwise it wouldn't be honest, and then it just won't write. So I have found that just going through the process of writing these two books brought me more and more down to earth, less and less sort of off in my own head, trying to feel more in control over life and being worse at interacting with other people and listening to other people as a result. So I think I am better at all those things. I think I started off pretty bad though, so who knows how much even a lot of improvement doesn't mean I'm particularly
I think you're being too hard on yourself, Oliver.
Well, that's the thing as well, and that can be annoying, can't it, actually, that personality trait. But so yeah, anyway, the point I'm trying to make is I think you can't really engage honestly with these ideas and not be a bit changed,
transformed,
for the better with them. And if you're not engaging with them honestly, then you can't do the work, because as I'm sure you agree, right, that you, like, if your heart wasn't in this stuff, you couldn't, you'd go and do something else.
Absolutely. We wouldn't bother with it. You know, it's a lot of hard work to make something from an idea, as we know, from an idea into a grounded actual project and and make it meaningful to someone else besides yourself, much less yourself.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
So to end, there are 3 questions I'm asking all my guests. We kind of been skirting around this first one I'm going to ask, but I'm going to ask it to you explicitly. If you could live forever, would you? And why or why not?
I think I wouldn't. I am specifically talking about forever.
Yes.
As opposed to much, much longer than I expect. That I think I might well take. And the reason would be that, for reasons we've discussed, that I'm not sure I can put it all, I'm not sure I can get it exactly into words, but I just do think it would be hell to have that sort of total open-endedness, that sort of absolute lack of any preciousness to any individual day. Yeah, I think that would be, I think that people sometimes accuse me of like flirting with nihilism or meaninglessness because I'm talking about how tiny we are in the cosmic scheme of things. It's that that would be meaninglessness and nihilism, I think,
to have
no end ever coming.
Another question. Has your work changed your thoughts about death and or what happens after?
I think we've discussed the sort of first part of that quite a lot, and I think it has changed them, but also that you can spend a surprising amount of time thinking about finitude and not necessarily transform your thoughts about sort of death itself. I don't know what to think about what happens after it or not. I think the main thing I always come back to here is that consciousness, the feeling of, that we have as alive humans of being here, of sentience, awareness, emotion, like it is a fact that we basically have no idea whatsoever how the gray matter of our brains gives rise to this consciousness, if that's even what happens. So right at the heart of anything, and consciousness is what gives the whole of life any meaning, right? If you weren't conscious, nothing would matter. So right at the center of everything we do in life, there is this kind of total mystery.
Yeah.
And I think the sort of kind of epistemic humility that follows on from that means, like, we have no real grounds for feeling certain at all about what happens when the brain is no longer, when blood is no longer pumping through the body and the brain. So I've become more and more mystical about that, I think. So I've gotten older because, like, there's just no grounds for being confident that the naturalistic physicalist version of events is the true one.
Yeah, absolutely. And finally, looking back, how have you found the idea of death has animated your life and work?
I mean, I think I've sort of backed into it and been dragged kicking and screaming in many ways, but I have over and over again come back to this unavoidable thing that, like, this unavoidable truth that feeling one's way into the reality of limits, of which death provides the most ultimate, it's empowering and deepening and enlivening. It's all the things I wouldn't have assumed that it would be, but it really is.
I love that. That's your transcendent third. Well, thank you so much, Oliver, for being a part of the show.
It's been a pleasure.
And I hope I'll see you in person soon.
Yeah, I'd really like that.
I would too.
Diana.
So after each episode, we'd like to have a little chat about the interview. I'm here with my producer, Jess. And Jess, were you already pretty familiar with Oliver's work, or was this kind of new to you?
So I'd seen his work in The Guardian, and I was aware of his books. And actually, when researching ahead for this interview, the book, which is called Meditations for Mortals, it really struck me, the way that the concept of reading, like, it's a couple of pages a day. And I actually bought it for my husband because I thought that, you know, this is a really tangible. And he, again, a bit like Oliver, he really doesn't like the language that comes with a lot of this kind of gratitude work and mindfulness. It really turns him off. I'm quite open to it, but he's very much like, but I feel that the way that Oliver explains these concepts with such clarity is really effective.
Yeah, he's also got just such a great intellect. His approach is quite intellectual. And I think for certain people, that's a much more attractive and less off-putting frame than some of the more woo-woo stuff that we encounter in this world.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely it. It's spot on to you know, one of the reasons. And he's so successful, isn't he, you know?
He does a beautiful job. And I think it's so interesting. Like, clearly this was not where he started, but it's where he ended. And I think that's so, so interesting.
And from the perspective of, you know, having read his, you know, columns and seen bits of his written work in his books, I kind of figured that he would have it all together, but he actually seems quite openly fallible despite having this knowledge, you know?
Yeah. In my experience, I think that's what death contemplation does, is it makes you more human, not less, you know?
Absolutely.
If you'd like to find out more about Oliver Berkman and his work, visit his website, oliverberkman.com.
Thank you so much for joining us on Memento Morbid. Don't forget, if you have your own Memento Morbid, a story, memory, or reflection, perhaps even a question, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. To find out more about Morbid Anatomy and our happenings, you can visit our website at morbidanatomy.org. You can also find us at Morbid Anatomy on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, or check out our Substack at morbidanatomy.substack.com.
Memento Morbid is produced by Overcoat Media in partnership with Morbid Anatomy. I'm your host, Joanna Ebenstein. The series producer is Jess Gunasekra. Studio engineer, Fernando Velasco. Additional production and sound design by Katie Hill. Executive producer, Stephen Rajam.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.